little child who just made a commitment, who'd come to faith and made a decision to follow Jesus, said to one of their parents, "How do I know that I'm a Christian? How do I know that I'm a Christian?" How would you answer that question? As we look through Matthew, we're thinking a bit about discernment today and how we discern what's really going on. How do we discern what discipleship really looks like? What true discipleship is? Both for us as we're disciples, as we seek to follow Jesus, how do we really know what's going on in our lives? And as we seek to make disciples, how do we understand what true discipleship looks like? How do we discern what's really going on? How would you answer that child trying to work out what true faith really meant? How do we understand a sense of progress along the journey of following Jesus? That actually there might be a sense of moving on, of progressing. In some ways it would be simple, it'd be nice, wouldn't it, if we had something really clear, a kind of a very sort of religious order thing that you kind of progress through different ranks of it. And we know that there's religions and cults around that have much more of an attitude like that, that, you know, you start at one level and you move up along, which maybe you have to learn something or pay something, and you kind of move up through the ranks. And in some ways, it's nice, isn't it? We like that sense of order. Those who were here yesterday at the ordination, Emma, who was speaking, said we pointed out that we love to order things. We love having a sense of order, and so I can see the attraction of that. But of course, we know, isn't it, that that's not what we find in the Bible, this sense of there being levels that you progress through. But neither do we have something that's bland and all relative and sort of the, we're all on a journey, aren't we? And it's all the same, really, isn't it? That no one's different from anybody else. It's all just this kind of bland relative thing. It's not what we see here. As we look at this passage, we see that there is something to discern, something to be understood. That true discipleship does look like something. There's something that true discipleship is, and there are things that true discipleship is not. It might be helpful to have the passage open in front of you. If you haven't got it already, you'll find it on page 972 of the Bibles that are provided. And we read straight away there that true discipleship is the narrow way. Enter through the narrow gate, for wide is the gate and broad is the road that leads to destruction, and many enter through it, but small is the gate and narrow the road that leads to life, and only a few find it. We are right towards the end of the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew. And we've had the last three Sundays before this, we've been looking at different bits of the Sermon on the Mount. And we've seen some of the challenge that it contains for us. And as we get to the end of this, this kind of closing section, Jesus points out right here that there's a choice. There's two ways. There's the broad way, the way that many will go, the way that's easy, the way that's self-determined. It's a choice of what I want to do. Or there's the narrow way, the way that's harder, the way that's costly, the way that isn't about me, but is about seeking to follow Jesus. The true discipleship is found following that narrow way, following him. And it brings on some of the demands that we've seen in the Sermon on the Mount, some of the demands that we've been hearing about over the last few weeks, that it is a challenge to live that life. We had it from Wale a few weeks ago, the manifesto that we find in the Beatitudes for following Jesus, for this life following him, that this is costly, that there is a challenge, that there'll be a cost to us at the start, maybe. For some of us, we may well know that point as we made a decision to follow Jesus, that there was a cost involved, that it's been a challenge, that there was something that we had to give up, that we had to give up that sense of following the broad way to following Jesus Christ, that we'll know there's been things we've had to pay the cost of to follow him. For others, we'll know that it maybe wasn't just at the start, but along the way, along the journey, there's been things that we've had to give up. There's been things we've had to say no to, because we know it's not what God has wanted for us. There's been a cost to following Jesus. Walking the narrow way is costly. But we know it from real life that sometimes paying the price is well worth it. If you've ever entered any kind of course of study, those who've been at school or studied for any kind of exams or further education, if you're a normal person, then you'll know at points it's been hard. That you haven't wanted to revise, you haven't wanted to write an essay, you haven't wanted to take the exam, you haven't wanted to go to school or go to the lecture. There's some people who aren't like that, who enjoy all of it, but they're the minority, I tell you. But why do we do that? Why do we sit down and spend hours revising? Why do that? Well, because we know that it's worth it at the end, don't we? We know because actually we want to do that because then we can achieve the best that we can get the result that we can achieve the best result that we can and lead that on to whatever's next for us. We know the cost is worth it. Or anyone who's ever got serious about any kind of sport will know that at times there's a great cost to be paid in preparing for that. Whether it's playing football and having to do endurance training and sprint training, or running and having to push yourself to go that bit further, that bit faster, that bit longer. And you'll know the difficulty, the pain, the struggle of that, that sometimes you don't want to go for a run in the rain, that actually you want to kick a ball around and not be doing sprints up and down a pitch, that actually you know there's that training you've got to do, that as much as it's hard and it's costly, it's worth it for what you're seeking to do. Jesus says, small is the gate and narrow is the road, that it's the road that leads to life. It's the road that's worth walking. I read a little bit about William Wilberforce this week, and for those who have no idea, he was the guy who was involved hugely in the abolition of slavery. And admittedly, I was reading a little bit on Wikipedia, so this is not the best source of information, never to be quoted in exams or essays. But what I read I felt was interesting, and it was well referenced, so I thought it's probably reasonable. And I wanted to share something with you. I didn't realise that Wilberforce had become a Christian later in his life. He became a Christian later on in life. And this is what it says about the time when he came to faith. At the time, religious enthusiasm was generally regarded as a social transgression and was stigmatized in polite society. Evangelicals in the upper classes were exposed to contempt and ridicule. And Wilberforce's conversion led him to question whether he should remain in public life. Wilberforce sought guidance, and both Newton and Pitt counselled him to remain in politics, and he resolved to do so with increased diligence and conscientiousness. Thereafter, his political views were informed by his faith and by his desire to promote Christianity and Christian ethics in private and public life. As I read that, I thought that was interesting because it's a reminder to me, perhaps a reminder to us, that it isn't just today that we feel like people mock and take the mick out of people seeking to follow Jesus, out of Christians. That you can be stigmatized for being a Christian. That actually, however long ago that was, people were facing the same problem. That it wasn't the in thing, that it wasn't regarded to be positive, to be enthusiastic about religion, to be enthusiastic about the Christian faith. And yet Wilberforce faces that. He faces that decision about whether he's going to withdraw from public life, whether he's going to step back and hide his faith away, or whether he's going to come out and show it clearly, and makes that decision to show his faith, his views, to inform his life in the world. That he sought to live differently because of the faith that he held. And if you know the story, you'll know how much that changed the world that he made that decision. If you don't, you can watch it in a film, so it's reasonably easy to do. Walking the narrow way is sometimes costly, but it also leads to a changed life, as we saw in Wilberforce. We go on in the passage, verse 16 and 17. By their fruit you will recognize them. Do people pick grapes from thorn bushes or figs from thistles? Likewise, every good tree bears good fruit, but a bad tree bears bad fruit. A good tree cannot bear bad fruit, and a bad tree cannot bear good fruit. Thus, verse 20, by their fruit you will recognize them. True discipleship is something that bears fruit. But what do we mean when we talk about bearing fruit? Well, if we have a look a little bit earlier on in Matthew, if you turn some pages back, you'll find that it's not the first time this sort of thing has been mentioned. Chapter 3, verse 8. John the Baptist preaching says this: produce fruit in keeping with repentance. Produce fruit in keeping with repentance. In verse 10, the axe has been laid to the root of the trees, and every tree that does not produce good fruit will be cut down and thrown into the fire. Produce fruit in keeping with repentance. It's about turning away from doing wrong to turning to doing good deeds. At the heart of it is simply about doing good. And of course, we're here at the end of the Sermon on the Mount. We've just had a huge manifesto, as Wale described it, from Jesus about what it means to be a follower of him. We've seen what it means in the Beatitudes, the way it changes us and seeks to change the world, this character change that it brings. Paul spoke to us about what it means to be salt and light, that it changes how we seek to influence the world. What a great example in Wilberforce about going to be salt and light in the world. It changes how we view righteousness, that it's not just something that's external, but it's about what goes on even in our thoughts, what it means to seek to be truly righteous. It changes what it means to be devout, what our patterns of devotion look like, as we were thinking about last week, that it's not about what it looks like on the outside, but it's about what's going on the inside. It changes our ambitions, that we're not seeking money. You can read about it in chapter 6, treasures in heaven, that we don't seek after money and physical wealth, but we seek to store up treasure in heaven, that we don't worry about what we need in our daily lives. It changes our relationships with others. Do to others as you would have done to you, Jesus says. That's something of living that fruitful life. And of course, it's what we all think of immediately as well, or many of us will do, the fruit of the Spirit. That part of that fruitful life is about displaying that love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, gentleness, faithfulness, self-control. Bearing the fruit of the Spirit, the fruit of God at work in our lives. In John chapter 15, we read about Jesus talking about him being the vine and us being the branches. And he says that if we remain in him, we'll go on to bear much fruit. There's a promise there that we will be able to bear much fruit. But it comes from remaining in him. That we need to remain in him. Jesus says that the gardener, God, is at work on us. He's at work on us, the branches, pruning us, preparing us, helping us to bear fruit. This changed life following the narrow way should be a life that shows that the gardener is at work on us. That actually he is at work pruning us, moulding us, shaping us, and helping us to be fruitful, to bear fruit for him. Sometimes perhaps that's hard for us almost to agree with, because perhaps that sometimes we don't feel that fruitful. And sometimes it's because there's work going on inside, because there's that pruning going on and we're being changed. Other times there will be that very visible external fruit for all to see. But maybe other times there's the challenge about how much we are bearing fruit, about how much we are seeking to remain in Jesus. As we follow that narrow way, we'll live differently. Will have changed lives. People will be able to see that the gardener has been at work. True discipleship is walking the narrow way. As we go on, we see that true discipleship is not always as it seems. I enjoyed this particular picture. I also enjoyed that one. Sometimes things are not quite as they seem. I'll give you a minute to look at that and work it out so you don't get distracted. All happy now? Okay, good. I shall move on. Sometimes things are not always as they seem. Verse 15, watch out for false prophets. They come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ferocious wolves. But some people may look like sheep, may look like members of the flock. Jesus being the shepherd and us being his sheep might look all right on the outside. But we're told that they won't show that evidence of fruitfulness, that fruit that we've just been talking about. And we're told that that's not just something that's kind of an inconvenience or something we should be aware of. We're actually also told that that's dangerous. We're told that these people are wolves. The wolves are the enemy of the flock. The wolves are the ones that come and eat the sheep. That actually, that false pretense is dangerous. True discipleship is not always as it seems. It's not always about the words. True discipleship is not about empty words. Verse 21, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven. Jesus is pretty clear that just saying something doesn't mean we enter the kingdom of heaven. And I think that's a challenge, particularly to us today and our sort of part of church life, because today we can be quite heavily focused on what people say. We can be quite heavily focused on sort of conversionism, that what's important is that someone comes and makes a particular confession of faith or says a particular prayer. And those are the things that sometimes get counted in our circles of church life, that festivals and conferences or evangelists will talk about afterwards, the number of people who came and said a prayer. And yet Jesus here is pretty clear that that's not what it's all about. That not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven. It's especially relevant to us today because today, words are cheap. So often people say things that they don't really mean, that they find a way to windle their way out of in one way or another. Words are cheap. Words are so cheap that Ed Miliband had to try and write it all on a big piece of stone to get people to believe him that he meant what he was saying. It still didn't work. And cost however many thousands of pounds it did for a big piece of stone. That wasn't cheap. People don't believe what one another say. Words have become cheap. And of course, we can all have the right vocabulary, can't we? We can all say the right things. We can all know the right things too. We can all have the right knowledge in our minds. We can say it, we can know it, but we can quite easily not mean it and not believe it. It's pretty clear here that what we say has to turn into action. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only the one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. That what we say has to turn into action. True discipleship is not empty words, but is those words turned into action. It's obedience to the Father's will. That's the test of what faith looks like. That's how we discern what faith looks like. It's about being obedient to the Father's will. We find it not just here, but we find it in other places too. Romans chapter 2. For it is not those who hear the law who are righteous in God's sight, but it is those who obey the law who will be declared righteous. And James. And James chapter 1. Do not merely listen to the word and so deceive yourselves. Do what it says. Anyone who listens to the word but does not do what it says is like someone who looks at his face in a mirror and after looking at himself goes away and immediately forgets what he looks like. But whoever looks intently into the perfect law that gives freedom and continues in it, not forgetting what they have heard, but doing it, they will be blessed in what they do. It's not salvation by works. It's not that we're saved by what we do. But it's that obedience to the Father is what it means to say Jesus is Lord. True discipleship is not about empty words. We also read here that true discipleship is not about the spectacular. Verse 22, many will say to me on that day, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name and in your name drive out demons and in your name perform many miracles? That actually, the external things, those gifts, those things we might display, are not what it's all about. They're not the demonstration of what it means to be a true disciple. As I was thinking about this, I wondered about Judas, having gone around with the 12 disciples for years. I can't imagine that he was the only one that wasn't in some way involved in performing miracles or driving out demons or anything like that. But then we know that Judas wasn't really following Jesus. Or a clearer example comes in 1 Samuel chapter 19. Saul sent some men to try and capture Samuel in that chapter. You can read about it. He sent some men to go and try and capture Samuel, and sends a few of his army, and they come along, and they meet Samuel and some of the other prophets, and they're prophesying, and all the men he sends ends up start prophesying. And so they come back and they say what happened. And then so he says, oh, it's useless, and send some more men to go and try and capture Samuel, and the same thing happens again. They all turn up and they all start prophesying. Oh, this is useless. I'll go myself and do it. So Saul goes himself to do it, goes and meets Samuel. And you know what happens? Saul starts to prophesy when he meets Samuel. Those external things don't mean that we're all right on the inside. They're no substitute for a life of obedience to the Father's will. True discipleship is not about the spectacular. True discipleship is about a life that is built on Jesus. It's about being built up in him. We reach the end of the Sermon on the Mount here. And we find that actually this isn't some kind of moral message. This isn't some kind of do good, be nice message. People love to talk about Jesus as being a good teacher, as someone who taught us good moral values, and yet we can all agree with that, can't we? And when you look at the Sermon on the Mount, you see that kind of stuff, don't you? You say, yeah, this is nice. Do to others as you would have done to yourself. We can all agree with that. Every humanist can nod along and be happy with that. But when we come to the end of the Sermon on the Mount here, we find that that's not the message that Jesus is giving. That it's not a simple be nice to other people message. But this is thoroughly built upon him. Verse 23, we read that entry into the kingdom is found by whether Jesus knows you or not. Then I will tell them plainly, I never knew you. Away from me, you evil doers. The entry into the kingdom is about whether Jesus knows you or not. In the last part of the passage that we didn't read, but that very familiar Sunday school story about the two people, the two men who build houses. One builds them on the rock, one builds it on the sand. The one who built it on the rock was the one who hears the words of Jesus and puts it into practice. This putting it into practice, the words of Jesus, is what it means to walk this narrow road. Right at the beginning and the end of this kind of summary, at the end of the Sermon on the Mount, we see this choice. Do you build your house on the words of Jesus, on the rock? Do you follow the narrow way? Or do you build on the sand? Do you follow the broad way? We're given this choice. And of course, it's hard. It's hard for us today, isn't it? Because we don't like things being boiled down to those few options. For those who were watching Wimbledon last Sunday afternoon, if you turned on your coverage early enough, you would have seen some interviews with the players. And you might have caught, possibly, the interview with Djokovic beforehand. And the BBC being the BBC, we're very interested in the fact that Djokovic is a Buddhist. And in his time, while he's in London, will go off and go and pray at a Buddhist temple in London. And, but it was interesting to hear what Djokovic had to say about it, because he said, oh, I'm not exclusive. You know, I believe that all ways are different ways to God, that we're all trying to find different ways to reach out to God, and, you know, no religion is better than the other. Very kind of politically correct today. And that's so often what people look for. But Jesus, as he speaks here, he doesn't accept the pluralism of his day. The people who were saying that sort of thing then. And he doesn't accept the pluralism of our day. He doesn't say there's lots of ways. He says that there are two ways. You can go the narrow way or you can go the broad way. You can build your house on the rock, you can build your house on the sand. And we want it to, this to be about the very good or the very bad, and not about the many of us. But here we find it's about the many, And it's not about what we're comfortable with, but it's the simple presentation that we have, or whether that's in or out. Are you going to follow me or not? And this isn't actually about what Djokovic says, because this isn't actually about lots of different ways for people to reach out to God. This isn't about religion. Sometimes religion has been described as man's attempt to reach God. Because actually we see in Jesus Christ that we can't reach God. That's the whole point, the whole message of the gospel, is that we couldn't reach out to him, that we couldn't do it in our own strength. And so Jesus comes to reveal God to us as God's revelation of himself and God's rescue for humanity. That in Jesus, we see Jesus, the King, coming to bring the kingdom. That he came not to condemn, but to save. He came to give people another way. That people could choose a way to follow him. That there was a way to be rescued from humanity's self-centeredness and sin. That the revelation of God's mercy is found in Jesus Christ. That's what we're going to come and celebrate in a few minutes' time as we share communion with one another. That actually God came in Jesus Christ. That his body was given, his blood poured out, that we might be rescued. The revelation of Jesus is the revelation that gives us the choice about whether we'll build our life upon him or not. Whether we'll choose to be obedient to the Father's will or not. The mark of true discipleship is found in Jesus Christ. In whether we build our lives upon him. The message that we have to take to the world is that we will be and we will make disciples who are built upon him. How do I know that I'm a Christian? It was a question that I asked my mum shortly after being on a Christian conference when I was about 8 or something like that, and having made something of a decision to follow Jesus. And it was a slightly tactical question as a child, because I asked it at bedtime. And my mum said to me, well, pray to Jesus and ask him to help you be sure. Which isn't, of course, the whole picture. It's not the whole answer. She wanted me to go to bed. But at its heart, it's about following Jesus. The true discipleship is about knowing him more. Is about following him, knowing his word, and putting it into practice.